ARP proxy. This is a pretty uncomplicated command. You put it in if you want to have proxy ARP active. Probably should have done this the other way around, but by default, the iPad does not turn on our proxy ARP, so if you want it, you have to turn it on. I probably should have defaulted that the other way. If you want to do RIP routing protocol, router-to-router protocol, you say RIP notify IP address. That's the address of the other router you want to talk to. An interval defaults to 30 seconds. If you wanted to talk to that router at some other period, you'd put an interval of however many seconds you want it to be. RIP version 1 or RIP version 2 is which version of RIP? By default, the iPad uses RIP 2, so if you talk to things like a Cisco router that will get upset with that, you'll have to put RIP version 1 in here. If you talk to multiple routers with RIP on different networks, you'd load just multiple RIP notify commands, and it'll talk to however many places you want it to. These addresses, we tell you to put the router address in here, but the truth of what happens in RIP is it broadcasts to a network. So if you have three or four routers on one Ethernet, you really don't need to list them all. It's harmless to do so, but you really don't need to. Again, that won't be normal that you'll have that. For those of you who have done RIP on other things and you know that you normally list the network, you can put just the network here. That's okay, too. Just put .0 at the end of it or whatever. I did this because it seemed to me simpler to think about RIP notifying another router. So let's just put the address of that router in there. But what it's really doing under the surface is taking that address and figuring out what network it's on and doing a broadcast to it. You have four log files. The system log is your basic activity sort of log. Talks about people logging in, logging out, things happening. The mail log logs all the email transactions, POP sessions, SMTP sessions, where mail goes. The error log logs system errors, which in theory could be addressed on your iPad. It does not log errors that it detected at systems you don't control. Those show up as warnings in the system log. If another system failed, that will be a warning in the system log. Error logs are errors on your system that in theory perhaps you could control. There's one exception to that rule, and it's proved to be a real problem explaining it to people. When you get bad DNS packets given to you by another system, it logs them in the error log. And by these rules, then you would naturally call me and say, what should I do to my iPad to make this error stop? Because it's not supposed to be there if you can't. But in that particular case, it's not really, it should really have been a warning over here. Billing log outputs transactions for Telnet and dial-in of when people call in, when they log off, so that you can generate accounting to charge for those functions. And the debug log normally won't have anything much in it. It does dump hex dumps of bad DNS records you get from other servers, because I'm still trying to prove that they really are that and not something I misinterpreted in some... This thing has not been in the field in my mind long enough at 12 months for me to have seen every kind of bad DNS record some system's supposed to give me that I might be able to understand anyway. So I log all of those in the debug log. When I think they're a bad format, I put the hex dump in the debug log so that you can send it to me and I can see if maybe it's me that didn't understand and I should have scanned it better. Otherwise, the debug log is basically for trace information. When you turn on your debug command to trace IP packet activity to debug interfaces, or you do domain traces to get debugs of DNS lookup issues, that's what goes in the debug log. You have some keywords over here that are detailed in your manual: normal, terse, detailed, extreme detailed and diagnostic, and it's just how much do you want to see there? I mean, do you want to see every little detail? If you put diagnostic on all these logs, you really will fill up your disk fast, and you may even slow the iPad down because it'll spend all its time logging, because it basically tells you every time it thinks about doing something along with what it does. That's it. That's configuring an iPad. And that's pretty much everything you do with an iPad. We didn't go through the FTP user log. I'll go through that with you right after the break, but it's getting break time, so let's take a quick break. It's 3:30. Let's try to get back here by 9:45. I'll give us 45 minutes till the 4:30. Pick what I think are the most important pieces out of what's left and do it as quickly as I know how. Again, there was one thing somebody brought up to me about the iPad that I did not mention, and I'll do it real quickly, and that's the maintenance telnet option. I don't know if there's a default in here for that or if I have to make it up from memory. I think I have to make it up from memory. I'm pretty sure I get it right. You have to turn on the telnet server on the server line. Word telnet, you have to turn that on. And then you put in your file a command that says maintenance. With an IP address, and you have to put like IP address in front of it or it'll get real. And then you put whoops, what did I just do? Hopefully nothing too serious. I did not hit at all the key I intended to. And a password. Now this password is case sensitive and may be up to 60 characters long. The key is it is case sensitive. That is, an upper and lower case characters are different at this password level. Now, assuming I haven't hosed this configuration file too badly here in doing these examples, let's see if I... get rid of these extra things I put on here to demonstrate, which are not going to correspond to the way it's wired up right now. If I have a maintenance telnet console, then I take any telnet client and I telnet that maintenance address. And I get what looks just like a Cisco router logon. And I put in my password, and I get to the maintenance prompt. Now, the maintenance prompt has two levels. The first one doesn't let you do much. You can ping things from here, and you can log off, and you can do some stats, like you can do a stat mem and stuff. No, you can't even do most of the stats. What is it you can do from here? You can, like, do the basic check IP and TCP, and you can do some various stats from here. And that's all you can do. At this prompt, same as you could at the regular CMD prompt, you can put in an @. And if you do, it asks you for a logon. And this logon is going to come out of your FTP user file. And I think, yes, I remembered what I put in there for this program. Say, Pat, it's a name of sysop with a password of secret. And you now get into the maintenance supervisor mode. And in the maintenance supervisor mode, you can do much of what you can do from the console. You can do domain reloads. You can do domain transfers, domain traces. You can take your lines up and down remotely, you know, reset modems and do things like that. You can do NS lookups. You can do pings. You can control your SMTP server, do status, hold, bounces, retries, mail, individual mail control. You can do all of the stats. You can do trace route. So you basically can, with this, do a significant amount of remote maintenance. It's not the same as full remote maintenance, but you have the option to do a lot of things and look at a lot of things. You can say, what would the console have shown me if I was in front of it? And it would have said that there are no active terminal lines, and some bozo is telneted in from 104.45.200 as a supervisor. And if there was anything else going on, FTP sessions, mail sessions, they'd all show up here just like you in front of the console. You can get your basic activity, how many files and mail and all this kind of information that's in there you can get. You can shut it down from here. That's not documented in the help, but you can do the shutdown command, and you can do the reboot from the supervisor mode. You can restart the box. You can shut it down. You can shut it down with an error level that passes back to a batch file if you want to encapsulate it in a batch file. So you shut it down with different error codes and make your batch file do things before it brings it back up. You have all those options from here. This is all in the manual. But a lot of things in the manual you won't look for if you don't know they're there to look for. Somebody brought this up. I thought this is an important enough piece of the iPad. I ought to mention that it exists so that you will look for it. I can't tell you if it's in the index in the manual or not. I would hope it was. Yeah, I understand. Well, I will tell you that the index was done at the end of the manual project with the deadline to get it to the printer looming. Now, I would not want to think that that would inspire us to under-index the manual, but it's possible.
Is there a listing of all the error codes, like the same delegation stuff that you see in the log file?
No. There's not a listing of all the log messages except the file that's on the board to download. There is a file that's been there for quite a while. It lists all the messages that can show up in all the log files. I forget what it's called, logmessage.txt or something. I believe it's what the name of it is. It's in the iPad download area, though. But anyway, that's a pretty significant part, the fact that you can do that remote maintenance telnet in. We use that a lot here for tech support because we can come in and look at all your stats and see what's going on in your box.
Can you go back to the iPad control file and show what you put in there?
Yes. Well, I think I can. If I can type YES, I can. To make the maintenance telnet come active, you have to have two things. You have to have the telnet server turned on your server line, even if you're not using it for any other reason, you have to say that it's there. And you have to add the maintenance command. And I'm sure the maintenance command is somewhere findable in the table of contents or index in your manual. There's a couple of other little options on the maintenance command, but these are the biggest. These are the two that really count. What's the IP address you telnet to make it come up the maintenance? If you have telnet turned on and you do not have any maintenance commands in your system, every interface address that you define that is not your host address, in other words, you have the host address command up here, every interface that you define an address for that's different than this host address will respond if it's telneted to with the maintenance address prompt, but there will be no password or possibility of logging in. The reason for that is to make life look like people who are providers expect it to look when you put an iPad in. Because remember I told you on your leased line you're going to put in your address and your net mask because he's going to tell you to do that? A lot of providers want to see your lines up by telneting your router, and they know you put a Cisco at the end of the line. So if they telnet it, they see the prompt, and they hit carriage return at the password 3 times, and it goes away, and it looks like a Cisco was there, they know the line's up. That's called just giving them what they expect to see. If this irritates you, you can put maintenance off, and it'll go away. But generally speaking, that's how that works in a way. It doesn't do anything you didn't expect, because you never expected Telnet in those addresses to do anything. And when your provider does what he expects, he sees what he expects. And that's just a little bit of this making, you know, a lot of times the way to get through problems is not to raise flags, and that's to make things look like people expect, and they don't ask questions. They're comfortable. And you just have a whole period of explaining what you're doing goes away because it looks like he thought it would look. And that's why that looks just like a Cisco router prompt for the maintenance console, is so that when it's in that setting on your, when it's your interface to your leased line, and somebody wants to telnet your router, they can do it, and it looks like they would expect it to look.
By the way, that's under configuring the maintenance server.
Configuring the maintenance server is where you would look for this in the manual, I'm told. And it's in the table of contents. However, there's some evidence it may not be in the index. But I wouldn't want to say that means we did the index in a hurry at the end of the project with the printer standing there waiting for the masters. I would never want to say that. Did I see a question out here before I go on?
What's the address that goes to put in the maintenance?
Oh, the IP address? Any one you want to make up that's different than anything else you have that you would telnet to, and that just becomes what you telnet to. No, you don't have to set up anywhere else. By putting it on the maintenance command, all routing, all understanding that I'm a host for this, everything just happens under the surface. Because it knows it has to happen to make that work, because if you want that to be the maintenance address, all the substructure has to be established. So simply by putting that address there, it all happens. That's right. You normally would want to pick one, and you probably wouldn't even want to put a domain name on it, generally, because you'd want it to be sort of a quiet, not secret, but at least unpublished kind of thing. I mean, you could always make maintenance.esoft.com and then telnet to it. I mean, if you want to, it's okay. It's your DNS. You can put the line in your DNS and give it a name if you want to. What we do here is on our interfaces, we put like router.esoft.com and give them names and stuff so that they reverse out and things like that in trace routes. Okay, now what we're going to do is I'd like to spend a couple of minutes discussing the basics of security. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to do this in the kind of detail I wanted to. I'm going to give you two or three simple things that I think are most of it. And a lot of the questions that get answered, you don't have to worry about it. I'm just going to probably try to go past real quick and not do. But there's two aspects to security. Security issues occur on levels and layers. The first layer is the IP packet itself. When IP packets themselves are circulating around, there's the possibility that somebody could hook a wire and tap them and read your packets and find data in them. Not real likely, except inside a large company on their land. That's where 90% of that kind of activity occurs. Everything's going through the Ethernet. Somebody drops a sniffer program and just sort of starts watching what's going through their land. Out on the Internet, once it's gone on a leased line and started through the Internet, you got to do the same thing to do that you'd have to do to tap a phone. You're going to have to go somewhere and hook up to a wire. And it just doesn't happen too often. I'm not going to tell you it can't happen, because it absolutely can. I'm just saying in real life, it just doesn't very much. 99% of the packet sniffing security breaks happen inside a company. This is why it's so funny to watch people put in firewalls to stop them. Because they put in the firewall to keep the outside world out, and 90% of their problems aren't happening from there. They're happening at the people who are still inside the firewall with the data. And that's a statistic, by the way, that most of the firewall companies will tell you is true, is that most of the security breaches at that level happen inside the company in the LAN. Because it's just real easy to do, or inside a university in a LAN or something, where the LAN's there, a student can go to a student workstation, drop a sniffer program in, and start watching packets and look for passwords and all that kind of stuff. The other part of IP packet security, there's really only one other issue besides sniffing that's a problem. There are two or three things that can be done, but most of them don't do any good anymore. One of them is that the IP protocol has an option at the IP level to do what it calls source routing. That says you can actually dictate in the packet how you want a packet to travel. So it doesn't, the router doesn't use route tables. It walks the packet and sends it to what's next. And you can defeat all the normal routing of the internet and make your packet go a totally different way. But every router made has an option to turn that off, and they're all turned off. So that mostly doesn't work in the internet. A source routed packet will never make it to the destination with source routing. It exists. The iPad ignores source routing. If it sees a packet with source routing in it, it will return an error message that says, I won't do your source routing. And there's no way to turn it on. Because it's not realistically used for anything meaningful. It just happens to be there. That's true of almost every router in the internet as well. The other one that happens is called spoofing. And you may have heard about TCP/IP spoofing. It takes an incredibly sophisticated person to do it. They have to have extremely in-depth understanding of the TCP protocol, so much so that they can predict the form of the packet that will be sent to them by a packet they send to a host. What they do is they put the address, their destination address, not as their real one, but as an address that's on the LAN inside the company or inside the building. And then they try to hit like a Unix box or some system in there that they understand how to log on to. And they feed it a packet to open the TCP connection. And they know the ACK's going to be sent back to them, but it won't be routed to them. It'll be sent out on the LAN. But because they're sophisticated enough to predict what that packet looks like, they can accept it, process it, and they do one half of the stream knowing what the other half's going to be. They go ahead, they log on to that Unix box, and they let them be give themselves some name, or they log onto an NT box, and they go through authorization, and they give themselves an ID and a password in this spoofing way with data they never see coming back. Then, after they've done that, they can come in the normal way with their normal IP address and log on as super user and be in your system. The good news for that is there is a 100% absolute preventive fix for that is a packet filter with one line in it. That line simply says that you will not allow packets in to your router from any interface that has the address of some other interface as their source. Then you can't be spoofed. And that brings us to the concept of packet filters. In your manuals, there's a whole story about the detailed syntax of filters, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on exactly how you specify them. I'm going to do them real quick, and the syntax is all in your manuals. What I want to get across is the reasoning and the general why and what you're trying to do. In the iPad control file, we can open this up a little and get a more light in if you guys can see enough there. Okay. In your iPad control file, remember we named every interface. So every TCP/IP interface has a name. If you want to apply a filter, you say filter, and then you would say the interface name, say our least line. Here you have some options for protocol. You can say it's a TCP packet, an IP packet, a UDP packet. You can say it's a TCP packet that's opening a circuit or one that's only on circuits that are already open. Those options are there to help you construct filters that let you do very elaborate things, like you can let people use your FTP server but nothing else from the outside. There's a lot of options that you can build like that based on them. If this is our least line, you'd say packets coming in of any protocol, that's where you'd put TCP IP, in this case, any protocol, I don't care what it is, if it has a source address, meaning that the address it's coming from is my local network. I hit an extra key here. And I'm not apparently going to hit the delete key first try either. And I don't care where it's going to. So this filter says any packet coming in the SS0 interface, no matter what protocol that packet's part of, if it came from any address that's anywhere in this Class C network, that's the network slash netmask, same specification, that means any address in my Class C network, no matter where it's headed to, and then you get to the other keyword in filters. You have two options here on a filter. You can deny or you can permit. Once you start a filter on any interface, there is an implied final which you can specify, but you don't have to. This is always added at the end of any filter list you build. What it means is that once it starts out by permitting anything. If you don't have a filter, any packet that routes right can go anywhere. As soon as you put a filter down, what it now says is any packet that you don't let in with your filter won't go. Therefore, you have to explicitly, for this simple filter, add an extra line. I'll put a semicolon in that because you don't type it, but that's effectively there at the end of your filter list. Now, what does this mean? Filter lists are processed in order. And as soon as a packet matches a line in a filter, that's what happens to it. Permit or deny occurs right then. If it doesn't match this line, it goes to the next line. That's why in this filter, which really has two lines, remember this one I've got a comment is I'm just letting you know that's effectively always there at the end. Because if a packet doesn't match anything all the way down, then it's denied.
Does it need an SS0 before?
Yes, it does. You're right. You're quite correct. I left that out. What this says is if a packet comes in and it looks like it's coming from an address on my Ethernet, then it should never be coming in here. It's a spoof. So deny it. Any other packet that comes in, take. That simple filter is a 100% prevention against spoofing attacks at the IP packet level. It can't be done if you do that.
Well, what happens if your internet access is like a pipeline, same pipeline?
The question is, what happens if your internet access is coming through a router that's not the iPad? Then if it allows you to build filters, you can do this. If it does not allow you to build filters, you can't. You have to do it where the interface is it comes in on.
You got to do it like on the pipeline.
You'd have to do it on that. If that on the router that it's actually coming in on is where you have to do this. This filtering, almost every router has some kind of filtering. And I don't know of any that aren't sophisticated enough to do this. I think they'll all do this. This is a very simple filter. But in essence, the way this works is you say permit or deny, direction. Am I talking about packets coming in? Or am I talking about packets going out? The protocol, in this case, asterisk means any protocol. You might say only TCP packets or only UDP packets, or you have those options. If the packet says its source is any address that matches this, or its destination is any address that matches this. Now, you've got options. For instance, this is one of the things that was born of personal frustration with the Cisco router filtering. You can also do this. Any address that's not this LAN. And it will match, because in a Cisco, the only way you can do that is list all the other addresses in the universe in individual filter statements. And I said, that's not realistic. But it's frequent that you want to say any address that's not my network and do some filter based on it. So if you put an exclamation point in part of it, it says, if it matches this, throw it away. Rather than if it matches this, take it. It just flips the matching. You can also, on filters, do things like, say, TCP protocol and matches these ports, and that lets them only get to maybe mail and not to anything else and some of that stuff. A full course in filter building is pretty sophisticated. I would recommend highly the book from the New Writers publisher called Actually Useful Internet Security. I found it to be one of the most effective books at understanding some of these issues that's out there. It's from New Writers Publishing, and it's called Actually Useful Internet Security Techniques. And that's a clear slam at all the books out there that are claimed to be internet security techniques that all are lists of how to hack Unix and don't really tell you much else. This one actually walks down, and it does a very good job of explaining what each attack looks like and then how to prevent it. How would you stop somebody from coming in and using your DNS server? You would put a filter in here. You want them to do everything else. You just don't want anybody to come in over the internet from outside, and we're assuming SS0 is your leased line to the outside world. I got the cap locks button there. DNS is a UDP protocol. All DNS requests are addressed to a destination of some IP address with a port 53. If you deny any packet coming in that's UDP protocol addressed to port 53, no DNS request from the outside can make it to your server. There's a problem, however. That's your server, and somebody went to the root server to find out, and then they came to your server to get the answer. You want them to be able to do that, don't you?
Yeah.
What you don't want is somebody with his WinSock resolver to point at your server. Well, that takes up another case. Server-to-server UDP transfers not only start from port 53, or go to port 53, they come from port 53. Resolver requests always come from a port of 1024 or bigger. So what you would add to this you would say deny it if it doesn't come from port 53, aim to port 53. Then another server trying to get to your server would be from 53, which would not match a not 53 here, and it would get through. As you can see, we could do 2 days on this part alone. What I want you to understand is that you've got some very sophisticated filtering tools built into your iPad, far more than you see in most routers. Why? Because I've spent a lot of time trying to build filters with Cisco routers, and I fixed every problem in their syntax I didn't like that wouldn't let me say something I wanted to say. Yes. Did you have a question? Or?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, for normal usage, you know, as an ISP, how important is all this?
For normal usage in an ISP, it's not too important. What I would say is if you have inside on your LAN a Unix box, I would do the anti-spoofing filter. It's very low cost. Filters do slow down the router minuscule. 2 or 3 line filters, no deal. If you're making 60 line filters, you're probably going to really start to impact. You're going to see that slow down. If you don't have a Unix box, I don't know of anybody who knows how to spoof who knows anything but Unix. And I would assume that over time, NT will start to get vulnerable in the same way, but right now, today, I would not say it is. Spoofing is a highly sophisticated technique that I don't think anybody who's been out of college 2 years knows how to do. No. And what they're going to go for, when you spoof, remember what you're trying to do, is find a server on the other side that you know how to hack with a login. And what you want to do is go after a server that if the IP address comes from inside, you've got some secret quick way in to get big privileges because you're an insider. Well, in Unix systems, there are all sorts of ways to do this. The primary one is trusted server R login, which will let you go in with no password, no name if you have the right IP address. And so basically what spoofers tend to try to do is attack that, get logged in, and then authorize themselves another login after they're logged in as super user with our login. That's 90% of what they'll try to do first. If that doesn't work, they've got a half a dozen other things that are basically quick super user entries that people usually set up on Unix boxes for trusted servers, trusted people inside the LAN. And they'll just start hacking around. Because remember with the spoof, you're doing it in the blind. You don't know if it worked. You have to set up this big script, run it, and then call in and see if it worked. And basically, most of the people that do that do the things that are commonly done in Unix to make life easier for the insiders. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things in Unix you can set up that says if I do an R login and my host is in the host files, I don't even have to log in. Just bam, I'm in and I've got all these privileges. But then it's conditioned with IP address, so you can't do that if you didn't call from certain workstations inside the company. Well, if you know that, you go outside, you spoof that IP address, and bam, you're in. You run the scripts and do the things you're supposed to do, give yourself an ID to get in. So I would say that if I had a Unix box on the LAN that had access to any sensitive data, I would do this filter. It's a very low-cost thing to do, and you can go to bed and know nobody can spoof you. It's not possible anymore. The whole concept of being able to do it went away. Kingsley wants this filter real bad, I can tell. No, I understand. There's a lot of reasons. This filter's probably another one you'll run across a lot and want to do. That's so that people can't... Remember I told you if your DNS was full, you just give them your competitor's DNS and tell them to use it? This lets them not be able to do that to you. That's the general idea of filtering. Now, in the iPad, you've got another concept of filtering that goes like this. You have what's called user filters. The difference between a user filter when you put it in control file and is right here where you would normally put the interface. You put asterisk and some text name that you make up. And you can have as many of these as you want. Just each one has to have its own name. And now when you build your filter list, you use this same name in here instead of an interface. That basically makes a disembodied filter, not now hooked to an interface, but which has a name. And that name starts always with an asterisk, because that way it... You can have star SS0 and an interface called SS0, and it knows the difference. That's why. So now let's say that I want to deny in this interface any packet, no matter its source, that's not destined for my LAN. I'm trying to talk and type at the same time, and that's not working. So I'm going to type this second line, and then I'll tell you what it means. Now, what is this felt? I'll move it up the screen here a little bit, so I get it up above where people can see it a little better. Filter, star local, deny in any protocol, any source, if the destination is not an address on my class C. Filter, star local, permit in anything else. What does that filter do if it were applied to a dial-up line? They can't go out of the net. They can only go to your servers locally. That's all they can do. You now have a disembodied filter with the name local that says if you apply this filter to anybody, they can only access things on your Class C network. Well, that's why we've made this filter. We've given it a name. We probably did it for a reason, and the question is, how do I make this filter hook to anything? And the answer is, the way you make this filter hook to anything is you try to type, which apparently I'm not doing. It's the thumb. Is let us say that I go right here in this file and I do something like, say, type star local right here. Now what happens is this guy logs in, he doesn't have that filter. This guy logs in and he gets that filter. So when he connects, that filter's applied to his port, whatever one it was he dialed into, gets that filter report applied to the port until he hangs up and then it goes away. Yes?
Can we apply that to a domain?
You cannot apply that to a domain because the domain is a DNS thing, not a user. If you look at the structure, a domain's a name, it's global, it's for everybody. A domain doesn't mean anything, it's an IP address coming in. Now, if you wanted to apply it so that people who came to you from the outside world and you had, say, two IP addresses for your servers and you wanted that filter on one of them but not on the other, that way you'd go back and put it on an interface. And you build the interface to say if the source address is that other network, they can't go anywhere but here. But if the source address is this other network, they can go anywhere through here.
What about a group of users with email access through a domain?
Again, remember, we're talking about people who connect to your system.
Right.
And email users don't connect unless they dial in or unless they come in through the outside world. And then what you're interested in is where are they coming from? And none of that has anything to do with their domain name.
So what if you have a line or even
I think the answer is that what you're trying to do can be accomplished, but I don't think you've modeled the problem right for your question right now, and I'm not real sure what you're trying to do, but it's the old story. Your question as stated is not making sense. I don't mean that to mean you don't have a question that makes sense, but I don't think we've quite got the pieces put together to make your question be understandable to me right now. Yeah?
What happens when you have someone that you only want to allow access to maybe one or two IP addresses?
Well, the question is, what about when you have someone you only want to allow access to one or two IP addresses? Do you understand here? First of all, before we leave, do you understand how you bind a filter to a particular user? You just put it in their user log. You can have as many local, or many user-defined filters with as many different names as you want, so you can have filters that do different things, and some users get one filter and other users get a different based on what you want to do with them or what you want to let them do, and some get none, meaning they can have everything happen. Now I'll go back and address your question because it happens over here. I just want to be sure that if I stay back here in iPad control and define filters, you'll understand how they get hooked to users. So let me take this filter right here. And I'll make a copy of this much of it. And we're going to call it, limited. This is a limited guy. He can do a few things that aren't local, but he can't do everything. I'm making these names up, so you can, when you type them, you can make any name you like.
You may have a couple of verbs over.
That's right. So you'll let him do anything on your own land. That's the same first line, right? He can do anything on his own land, on your own land. But you've got a couple of other things you want to let him do. Whoops. Pardon? I don't believe right now it has that in there, no. Right. So let's say that there was a system out at 201.25.143.15 you wanted to let him to. Now, if he's calling in and he's sending packets coming in his dial-in interface that are trying to go to 201.25.143.15, you said no matter what the protocol, that's okay. And remember how filters work. As soon as it gets here and it's okay, and we don't look past there. Now he's trying to go to some other server, 207 dot something. Well, you don't permit that. You come down here, and that's not your local network. It's denied. He's out of there. The order in which you write them is how it's done. It's literally does the first one, then it does the second one, then it does the third one, and if it falls all the way out the bottom and you haven't allowed it, it's disallowed.
Well, the second one could be, instead of a 9, could be a mid and have another IP address.
Absolutely, and you can stack them up, and you can make these as long as you want, but when they start to get real long, you have to understand you might be starting to slow the router down a little bit. On a dial-up line, things happen so slow, you can make pretty big ones. On your Ethernets and your leased lines, you probably don't want to make these more than 15 or 20 long before you, unless you really need to. Yes?